They capture podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a real cornerstone text, a book that pretty much set the stage for how we even talk about individual freedom today, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty.
It really is foundational, isn't it? And what's striking is how relevant it still feels. You read it and think, wow, the debates we're having now about, say, cancel culture or free speech online, Mill was wrestling with similar things way back in 1859.
Absolutely. And that core tension, the big question Mill poses is just fundamental, isn't it? Where exactly do you draw that line? The one between my right to live my life as I see fit and society's right or the government's right to step in?
And he didn't just ask the question. He gave us an answer, a really clear benchmark. The harm principle, basically the government, your community, whoever, they can only restrict your freedom if your actions are actually causing real demonstrable harm to someone else.
That's the key. Not just offending someone or doing something unpopular.
Exactly. And what's fascinating, like you hinted, is that the big threat Mill saw wasn't necessarily, you know, the king or a dictator. With democracy on the rise, he saw the danger within society itself.
The tyranny of the majority.
Precisely. That's what he was really worried about. Because, well, you can vote out a bad government, right?
Yeah.
But public opinion, that constant subtle pressure to conform, that gets into every part of your life in a way laws maybe can't. Mill thought the harm principle was crucial to protect individuals from that kind of suffocation, the kind that crushes new ideas and stops people from, well, growing.
Okay, so let's talk about the person behind this. John Stuart Mill, born 1806. He sounds like he was basically designed in a lab to be a philosopher. His father, James Mill, and Jeremy Bentham, they put him through this incredibly intense utilitarian education. Greek at 3, seriously.
Oh, yeah. It sounds utterly exhausting.
Yeah.
And it almost broke him. He had this major mental health crisis in his 20s, realized that the strict sort of cold calculation of pleasure and pain he'd been taught, it just felt empty.
Mm.
And coming out of that crisis, he shifted his focus. It wasn't just about immediate pleasure anymore. It became about a higher kind of happiness, about human development, individuality, flourishing over the long term.
So that crisis was really pivotal. It moved him from just calculating utility to championing the conditions for people to actually develop their full potential. The greatest good comes when individuals are free to, well, be themselves.
Exactly. And we absolutely have to mention Harriet Taylor Mill, his wife eventually. Mill himself said she was a huge influence, a co-author in many ways. She really sharpened the arguments about individuality, about applying these principles equally, you know, including to women's rights. So his authority comes from this mix of rigorous theory, that personal crisis, practical experience from his day job.
Right. He worked with the East India Company.
Yeah, for years. And this profound intellectual partnership is a powerful combination.
Okay, so the book's purpose isn't just defining that line using the harm principle. What's the bigger goal?
It's really about setting that limit on power, government power, social power, specifically to let individual development rip.
Mm.
Mill's point is that these two things, individual freedom and a stable society, they aren't opposites fighting each other. It's not a zero-sum game.
Oh, okay.
When you maximize freedom for individuals to think their own thoughts, try new things, even be a bit weird, society actually benefits massively in the long run. That's the core argument.
And the book walks us through this systematically. He looks at two main areas where this freedom needs to be, like, absolute. First, freedom of thought and discussion.
Total freedom there, yeah.
And second, freedom of action, what he famously calls experiments in living.
Mm-hmm. And connecting that back, you might wonder, why would a utilitarian, someone focused on the greatest good for the greatest number, be so insistent on protecting, say, a tiny minority opinion or a really unconventional lifestyle? It feels a bit backward, doesn't it?
Yeah, you'd think, look, if almost everyone agrees, why waste time on the one person who doesn't?
Mill's answer is kind of brilliant. He says, because that one person, that unconventional experimenter, that's where progress comes from. Diversity, dissent, even eccentricity. They're vital resources. If everyone just conforms, society gets stuck. It can't fix its mistakes or find better ways of doing things. The oddball isn't a problem. They're potential solution providers.
Which brings us right back to fighting that tyranny of the majority. The danger is society using shame, ridicule, social exclusion, basically making it so uncomfortable to be different that people just give up. It's easier to fight a law than the constant pressure from everyone around you.
Definitely. And that's why the harm principle is the shield. He says, the sole end for which mankind are warranted in interfering with the liberty of action is self-protection. You need actual, identifiable harm to others. Just being offended or thinking someone's idea is stupid. Not good enough. Never.
Okay, let's dive into chapter two then. This is his massive defense of free speech. He lays out these four arguments for why you should basically never shut down an opinion, even if you're absolutely sure it's wrong. That sounds risky, doesn't it? Couldn't really offensive or false ideas cause harm?
Mill acknowledges the potential for offense, definitely. But he argues the harm of silencing speech is almost always greater. His first point is pretty humbling. The opinion you want to silence might actually be true. We think we're right, but history is full of examples. Socrates, Galileo, you name it, where the accepted view is dead wrong. Assuming infallibility is just dangerous.
Okay, fair point. What's the second argument?
That covers the messy middle ground. Even wrong opinions often contain a grain of truth. The dominant view is rarely the whole truth. So that dissenting, maybe even partly wrong, view, it often highlights something the majority is missing. It forces us to see the blind spots and get a fuller picture.
Right. It completes the picture.
Right.
But the last two arguments, they feel different. They seem to be about protecting the truth from, well, from becoming lazy.
Exactly. They're about preventing intellectual stagnation. Third point. If true opinions aren't constantly challenged, they become dead dogmas. People just repeat them without really understanding them. They become prejudices, not living beliefs. They lose their power to actually guide how you live.
You forget why it's true in the first place.
Precisely. Which leads to the fourth point. The meaning of the belief itself gets lost if it's never debated. Think about important ideas that just become cliches. Without engaging with opponents, without that friction, the real essence, the passion, the context, it all just fades away.
Wow. It's a powerful case for why we need disagreement. Okay, let's connect that to action. Mill says it's not enough just to think freely. We need freedom to act differently, to live differently. Chapter 3, Individuality.
Yeah, and this is where Mill gets really passionate. He champions individuality because, well, if you just follow customs without thinking, you're not really using your human faculties. You're just imitating. His phrase is amazing. You only need the ape-like one of imitation.
Ouch.
Right? But choosing your own path, your own lifestyle, career, whatever, that's how you develop judgment, perception, self-control. You become a fully formed person.
And society benefits again because these nonconformists are running those experiments and living. Trying out new ways to live, new ideas that the rest of society might eventually adopt if they work. Eccentricity isn't just tolerated, it's valuable.
It's the engine. If you stamp out eccentricity, you kill the engine of innovation. You just conform your way into stagnation.
So chapters 4 and 5 then try to get practical. How do we actually draw this line? We get the difference between self-regarding actions like what I eat, my personal habits where society keeps out, and other regarding actions where my actions affect others. But it gets fuzzy, right? Like, what about excessive drinking? It might not harm me directly now, but maybe it leads to neglecting family later.
That's the tricky part. And Mill dives into it. He clarifies it has to be a definite breach of duty or an assignable harm to others. Society can't step in just because it thinks your choices are unwise or, you know, immoral for you.
You know, so the classic example, if someone gambles away their own money, that's their business. Self-regarding.
Generally, yes. However, if they gamble away money they were legally required to use to support their kids, then they've breached a specific duty to others, the kids. Society can step in then. The focus stays on the harm to others, not the gambling itself.
He uses the example of regulating poisons too, doesn't he?
Perfect example. Mill says you don't ban poisons outright because people might need them for legitimate reasons. That restricts liberty too much. Instead, you regulate the sale, require labels, keep records to prevent specific harms like accidental poisoning or fraud. You manage the risk without killing the freedom.
That clarity is really helpful. Okay, let's boil this down. What are the big takeaways for, you know, everyday life?
Okay, 4 key things maybe. First, constantly use that harm principle as a mental filter. When you see outrage online or social pressure building, ask yourself, is someone actually tangibly being harmed here? Or is it just offense, disapproval, maybe fear of the unfamiliar? If it's the latter, Mill says, back off.
Good filter. Second.
Second, really internalize the value of dissent. Vigorous discussion, even with ideas you hate, is vital for knowing what's true. If you only listen to people who agree with you, your own understanding becomes weak. Actively seek out disagreement.
Makes sense. Third.
Third, beware the danger of custom. Just going along with the crowd leads to mediocrity, both personally and societally. Resisting groupthink, whether at work or in your social life, is crucial. Progress nearly always starts with someone swimming against the current.
And finally.
Finally, think about positive liberty. For Mill, liberty wasn't just freedom from being interfered with. It was freedom to become the person you have the potential to be. Choosing an authentic life, one that reflects your values, not just echoing others, that's almost like a duty for a free person.
Wow. Powerful stuff. And Mill expressed these ideas so memorably, too.
Oh, absolutely. His writing can be really striking.
Let's share a few of those lines that really capture it.
Okay, the absolute bedrock. The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised is to prevent harm to others.
Yeah.
His own good is not a sufficient warrant. That just shuts down paternalism right there. The state isn't your dad.
Huh, right. And the defense of the lone voice.
This one's amazing. If all mankind, minus one, were of one opinion, and only one person were of the contrary opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he would be justified in silencing mankind. Truth doesn't depend on a headcount.
So powerful. And the challenge to live intentionally.
That ape-like imitation line. He who lets the world choose his plan of life for him has no need of any other faculty than the ape-like one of imitation. It's a direct challenge. Use your own mind. Make your own choices.
And finally, how we measure a society's success.
The worth of a state, in the long run, is the worth of the individuals composing it. Simple, profound. The goal is flourishing individuals, not just an orderly state.
It's incredible how these ideas from the 1850s map onto today's world.
Totally. Think about the modern workplace. Mill's defensive dissent, that's basically the argument for psychological safety. Now creating environments where people feel safe to challenge ideas, to disagree, without getting shut down. Businesses that crush dissent often make terrible decisions because of groupthink.
That's a great connection. And what about bigger issues like technology, privacy, online speech?
The harm principle is essential there. It helps us navigate debates about surveillance or content moderation. When is it about preventing actual specific harm like fraud, incitement to violence, versus just controlling what people see or say because it's unpopular or offensive?
Mm-hmm.
That distinction is crucial. Is the intervention targeting assignable harm or just restricting self-regarding thoughts and expressions?
And on a personal level.
It's really a call to be authentic, isn't it? To consciously push back against the pressure, maybe especially from social media, to just conform, to actually choose a path, a career, a way of living that reflects who you are. It's permission, maybe even a responsibility, to develop your own unique character, to be that experiment in living.
Find your own kind of eccentricity, maybe.
Because that's where genuine happiness lies, according to Mill. Not in fitting in, but in being fully yourself.
You know, reflecting on this, what really hits me is that insight about the tyranny of the majority. We often think the threat to liberty is some external force, a dictator or something. But Mill warns us that the real danger, especially now, might be closer to home. It's the social pressure, the desire for conformity, even our own desire for an easy, uncontroversial life. That feels like the biggest challenge today.
I think that's absolutely right. And maybe the final takeaway is this. Individual freedom and social progress aren't enemies. Mill shows they depend on each other. Societies thrive, they innovate, they get better, precisely when they protect and even celebrate diversity, dissent, and those crucial experiments in living.
So liberty isn't something you achieve once and then forget about.
No way. It needs constant vigilance. Not just watching out for governments overstepping, but watching out for that subtle internal pressure in ourselves and in our communities to just smooth out all the differences and demand conformity. That's the quiet threat we always need to be aware of.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.